This is Miles from Hudson. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre Hudson Catskill.
Hear that? That's spackle being mixed with a spackle knife. It's one of the many exciting sounds happening off air to get much more exciting sounds on air. There are always projects to keep this station in tip-top shape and maybe growing, so if you'd like to help in this endeavor, email Kaya, K-A-Y-A, at WGXC.org. I'm not Kaya.
Well, good morning. I'm not Kaya either. This is Dan Arshak, and you're listening to the Criminal Law Show on WGXC 90.7 FM, Accra. The show today is a little unusual in that we're going to have a guest for most of the show, Marty Tankleff. I'm going to tell you more about Marty as the show progresses. But first, I want to speak a little bit about what criminal defense lawyers do, how they do it, why they do it, and how it is that Marty found himself in the position that he did back in 1988. Criminal defense lawyers are part of the criminal justice system. We represent people when they're charged with crimes. And frequently people ask us, how can you represent those people? The answer to that question, my lights, is really explained by a song that I'd like to play for you a little bit. By my lights, the criminal defense lawyer's job is to stand by a person charged with a crime, a person who's in a system that they don't understand, and to be their voice in their moment of need. So listen to this song for a minute, and then we'll get on with the substance of today's show.
Who you are, no matter where you go in your life, at some point you're gonna need somebody to stand by you. Oh yeah, oh my darling, stand by me, no matter who you are.
I have to say, as a criminal defense lawyer, that song brings tears to my eyes every time I listen to it, because it really does explain why it is we do what we do, and the thousands of times that people ask me, how do you represent those people? I want to plug in that song, and I want to play it to them because that's what it's about. Everybody needs somebody to stand by them. And when I say everybody, I mean everybody. In particular, the almost 1.7 million people who are in prison today in the United States. Think about that number, 1.7 million people. This radio station, if everybody in its listening area were listening today, we'd have 78,000 people listening. Of course, it's a much bigger listening area because it's through the internet as well, but that's just 78,000 people. 1.7 million people have been in jail, are in jail, in 2009. That number continues to go up. During this show, you're going to hear some discussion of some of the statistics associated with how many people are in jail and why they're in jail and what we're doing about it. We spend, and you should know that these statistics come from the Bureau of Justice Statistics, which is a part of the Department of Justice. We spent in 2007 $74 billion on housing people in prisons in the United States. We spend $104 billion in getting those people into prisons, in the just on the police, and we spent $50 billion in judicial resources in getting those people into prison. Here's some other statistics for you. I'm giving you these because I want to set the stage for the discussion that we're going to have in a little bit about how it is that errors can be made in our system that result in people who shouldn't be incarcerated being incarcerated. In our country, one out of every 15 people will serve time in prison during his or her lifetime. And despite the fact that the vast majority of people in our country are white, 64% of prison inmates belong to racial or ethnic minorities. It's horrifying that 32% of all black males will enter state or federal prison during their lifetime, 17% of Hispanic males, and just 5.9% of white males. I'm not advocating that there be more white males in prison, but I am suggesting that there's something wrong with our system that puts nearly a third of black males in federal prison or state prison during their life. And of those people who are put in jail, we would hope that the people who are put in jail are those who are convicted of violent crimes. But the fact is that less than a half of all of the people who are sentenced to jail are sentenced for violent crimes. There's 20% who are sentenced for property-related offenses, and 20% as well for drug-related offenses. We'll never know, because we have no absolute statistics, how many of those people who are put in jail are actually innocent. It's horrifying to think that that even one person would be factually innocent and yet be spending significant portions of their life in jail. But we know from the people who have been exonerated and found actually innocent of the crimes that they've been convicted of, we know that the vast majority of those have been convicted based on erroneous identification procedures. We know that a study in just based on New York of 53 exonerations found that of those 53 exonerations, 36% were as a result of wrongful identification procedures. Virtually the same amount were wrongfully convicted as a result of errors in government practices. That means something that the judge did wrong or something that the prosecutor did wrong. We know that errors in the way that forensic evidence was handled was also responsible for almost the same percentage. The amount resources that are allocated to defense of indigent defendants, and almost all of the defendants in New York State and in every state in our country is handled by public defenders. We know that the resources given to defense practitioners never equal those that are given to the prosecution or the government. And so we shouldn't be surprised that nearly 20% of the wrongful convictions in New York State occur as a result of the errors made by defense practitioners. And what's perhaps most horrifying is that false confessions count for something over 10% of all the wrongful convictions that occur in New York State. False confessions, confessions is something that we're going to talk about a little further with Marty Tankliff when he calls in. But ask yourself, how could it occur that that somebody gets arrested for a very serious crime, but ends up confessing to that crime, despite the fact that they were factually innocent and didn't do it? Well, when we say that they confess, what I really mean is that a confession is introduced against them at their trial. It may be that that they don't actually acknowledge that they ever made a confession, or it may be that they were coerced in one way or another, or tricked or one way or another into making a confession. Don't think that it can't happen, because the fact, the truth is that it does happen, and it happens with remarkable frequency. In a couple of minutes, we're going to hear from Marty Tankliff, who's going to call in. Marty, at the age of 17, in September of 1988, woke up on the first day of his senior year in high school to discover that his mother and father had been brutally murdered. They'd been stabbed and bludgeoned. They were dead. His father, Seymour, was just barely clinging to life. Marty tried to give first aid to his father, and he called 911. Shortly thereafter, Marty's father passed away. And Marty, despite giving information to the police as to who he believed was the perpetrator of this crime, Marty was arrested. Marty spent 17 years in jail. I'll cut to the chase. Before he was released, the charges against him dismissed, and the prosecution admitting that the amount of evidence that they had against him was not, should not have been sufficient to obtain a conviction. Marty's going to call in a moment, and we're going to discuss with him how it was that this happened, and what can be done to assure that it doesn't happen to people in the future. As we segue into Marty, we're going to finish with the song that we were playing a moment ago, and just getting used to this. There we go. I think we have Marty Tankliff on the line with us. Is that correct? Good morning, Marty. Whoops. I'm good. I think we've got you on the line. Marty Tankliff, are you on the line with us?
I am on the line.
Oh, that's great. I'm just getting the... this is a one-person operation here. I've got a little help. Shall I be hanging this phone up? I'm not going to hang up on him? Marty, are you still there?
I'm still here, Dan.
Oh, that's great. Marty, I'm so glad that you agreed to participate in this program today. This is our third program about criminal law issues, and I've heard from listeners and colleagues who have been involved since the beginning that they thought it would be quite informative to hear from somebody who really was involved in the system. The truth is, Marty, that no one's perhaps been more involved in the system than you have. I've described the fact of what occurred on September 7th, 1988, Marty. Why don't you pick up at that point in time that you were taken to the police precinct and tell us what happened then?
It's such a long and drawn-out story that I'll try to abbreviate it since it is a radio show. But on that day, I was brought to police headquarters in Suffolk County. An interrogation took place. After several hours, I was arrested. Several hours later, I was charged with the murder and attempted murder of my parents. Subsequent to that, I was released on bail. After I was released on my bail...
Marty, let me interrupt you at that point. You were charged with a double homicide.
Initially, I was charged with murder and attempted murder. My father had succumbed to his injuries several weeks later, so I wasn't charged with a homicide after that in October.
And yet you were released on bail. How did that occur?
There was an initial application for bail. That was denied. My lawyers made an appeal to another judge in Suffolk County. Bail was granted at $1 million bond, $500,000 cash. And my family did whatever they had to do to get me out on bail. And several weeks after my initial incarceration, I was released on bail.
Is it fair to say, Marty, that during the course of your entire ordeal, your family stood behind you?
That would be an understatement. My mother's two sisters, their family, my father's brother, their entire family stood steadfastly behind me, and they never wavered in their belief of me. They never wavered in the belief that the guilty parties were actually roaming the streets continuing crimes while I was languishing in prison.
Well, let's talk about the first interrogation of you by the police. What happened during that interrogation?
There's really no easy way to describe an interrogation. It's kind of difficult to put yourself in that position. But when you're brought up to trust in law enforcement and you're lied to constantly, you walk away with a sense of disbelief. I think one of my lawyers described it the easiest way of kind of knowing what it's like. If you've lost a family member or a friend, you don't realize where you are at that very moment, and no matter what somebody tells you, you're kind of accepting of that. An interrogation in many ways can be just like that, where you're in a complete state of shock, you're in a complete disillusion of where you are. And especially if you have a belief that law enforcement tells you the truth, they can feed you facts that you will just simply regurgitate, not realizing that it's a complete fabrication. In my situation, there was an interrogation. I was lied to constantly.
What was the first lie you were told, Marty?
Probably the first lie I was told that I was guilty. And they knew I was guilty because they had hair in my mother's hands that they knew were mine. They said they had done a humidity test, which proved that I wasn't telling the truth.
A humidity test?
A humidity test.
Is there any such thing?
To my knowledge now, there's no such thing. But back then, I was simply a 17-year-old kid who was brought up to trust law enforcement. Literally, I turned 17 on August 29th, and this happened September 7th.
What did they tell you about your father's condition during that interrogation?
At some point during the interrogation, Detective McCready had left the room and left the door open, a slight crack, and he had what we later learned was a fake phone call. And subsequent to that, he came running into the room, and he's like, "Marty, they pumped your father full of adrenaline, and he identified you as being the murderer, and he wants you just to tell us that you did the murders and just tell us why."
Was that true?
No, that was not true. It was a complete fabrication. It was a lie.
What was, in fact, your father's condition at that moment?
He was in a coma. He never came out of a coma, and he succumbed to his injuries almost a month later.
our audience might be a little shocked to hear that that the police lied to you. And have you come to learn, Marty, whether they were permitted to lie to you? Is that a legitimate investigative technique?
It's a very difficult question for me to answer. It's a yes and no. I know.
Well, let me make it a little easier for you. One of the bright notes of this process for you, Marty, is that I know you're now in law school.
I am.
And I'm certain that as part of your law school education, you've taken some criminal procedure courses.
Next semester.
Right. But certainly, given your own experiences, you know as a matter of law,
they are permitted to lie to you.
There you go.
But there's a point where it crosses the line. I was not an adult. I was a kid. And when you're dealing with youthful individuals, the depth of their lies really should be minimal. Telling somebody who just woke up and discovered their parents the way I did that their father identified them was a lie beyond reproach. Anybody who hears that is just astonished that the law would permit them to lie in such a level.
Marty, at some point, the police wrote down what they said was your confession. Isn't that correct?
At some point, Detective McCready had drafted a three-page statement that was introduced later on. It was never written by me, never signed by me, never initialed by myself either.
And was there ever a moment in the life of this case that you acknowledged that that confession was truthful?
Immediately outside the grips of law enforcement, I denounced every allegation that they said I made. I've always maintained my innocence. I've always maintained that whatever was attributed to me was false and was fabricated and was forced out of me.
Well, you say forced out of you, but in fact, the confession, the so-called confession that was introduced against you during your trial, in fact, the words of that confession never came out of your mouth, did they?
I would have to agree with that, yes.
Yeah. Some 2 years later, after you were arrested in September of 1988, in 1990, you went to trial.
That's correct.
And tell the listeners how that trial proceeded.
It was a lengthy trial. My case was a very, very high-profile case in Suffolk County, so there was a ton of media that was generated from the time of my arrest up into jury selection. The jury selection process was approximately 3 to 4 weeks. The trial was approximately 8 weeks. The jury deliberations lasted 8 days. After 8 days, I was found guilty. After there was a guilty verdict, we had post-conviction hearings that lasted several months. And in October of 1990, I was sentenced to 50 years to life.
In October of 1990?
Yes.
And at that point, you were 19 years old?
Correct.
At that point, did your family abandon you?
No. My family has never abandoned me. The one thing that they said publicly back then, as they've always said, especially after the trial, they said, we sat through this entire trial, and if you couldn't prove anything to us, you definitely didn't prove it to anybody.
And despite that, and despite what we know to be the rules that are supposed to apply to a criminal trial, that is that every person is supposedly innocent until proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, despite all of that, a jury convicted you. After your conviction, some pieces of evidence started to become somewhat clearer. Isn't that correct?
That is correct.
What was the first big break in your post-conviction experience?
It had to have come around 1994 when a woman by the name of Carlene Kovacs had come forward and told us that a man by the name of Joseph Creedon had admitted being involved in the murders. At that point, we had investigated as far as we could get successful. We ended up turning the information over to the Suffolk County DA's office, who did nothing with it. It wasn't until many, many years later, after much of my legal litigation had essentially exhausted, that everybody took a step back and said, we have to take a fresh look at this. And I went searching for a private investigator to conduct an investigation that had never taken place in my case.
Even during the trial of your case, you had some important ideas about who it was who had really killed your mother and father.
From day one, myself, family members, friends, all identified my father's business partner as the individual who is directly responsible for the murders.
In fact, that person actually owed your father $500,000. He'd, just before the murder, recently violently threatened your parents, and the night before the murder, he was the last guest to have left your home. Isn't that right?
That is all absolutely correct.
And let's just take a little further look at the fact. In the weeks after the attack that resulted in your father and your mother being murdered and your father lying unconscious in the hospital, that same business partner tried to fake his own death, and thereafter he disguised himself and tried to flee to California under an alias. Isn't that right?
He actually cleared out a joint bank account, faked his own disappearance, changed his appearance, fled under an alias to California, one of five or six different aliases he actually had. He changed his hair at a hair club for men in California that he wasn't a member of. He ended up hiding out in a psychiatric retreat in California. So to say that he disappeared under unusual circumstances would be an understatement.
Well, we have to imagine, because we've watched so many television shows and seen so many movies, that when that happened, the police marshaled their forces. They sent investigators to California. They arrested that man, and he's been thoroughly interrogated, and he's now sitting in jail. Isn't that right?
Quite the contrary. They sent some law enforcement out there to show him back to Suffolk County and embrace him as a warm and loving citizen of Suffolk County. Never arrested him, never considered him a suspect. And to this day, he has never really been considered a suspect, even through the post-conviction hearings, clear and convincing evidence has come forward of his direct involvement.
And as we're talking about clear and convincing evidence, Marty, the assault on your mother and father that resulted in their death, it was a physical and a violent assault, isn't that right?
The evidence would support that, yes.
And as I understand it, there's absolutely zero forensic evidence, that is, no blood evidence, no DNA evidence, no tool mark evidence that in any way tied you to this crime. Isn't that correct, too?
That is absolutely correct.
Well, I'm puzzled, and I'm sure our listeners are puzzled. Under those circumstances, how was it that a conviction was obtained of you?
You have to remove yourself from the present time and think about, 15, 20 years ago. We're talking about 1990. In 1990, our society had this understanding or this belief that prosecutors don't lie, detectives don't lie, there's no such thing as a false confession. And I think even back then, that when an individual saw somebody sitting at a defense table, there was a belief he was guilty of something. The presumption of innocence really didn't exist. If you sat at a defense table, you must have been guilty of something.
I'm going to just interrupt you for a moment at that point, Marty, and I just want to suggest to you that when you say that that was society's belief, I'm going to suggest that perhaps that was the society's belief that you came from at that point in time, and that perhaps in other parts of society that belief was really quite different. I'm not certain that in our minority populations, in our less advantaged populations, unlike the world that you grew up in, I think that the image of prosecutors who are out to get, police officers who lie, and a judicial system that's in cahoots with them was perhaps the norm and continues to be the norm. But I do understand that at that point in time, that certainly was your perception.
I would have to agree with you. I've always said that if it can happen to a nice white you know, middle, upper-class Jewish white boy from Suffolk County, how many minorities does it happen to on a daily, monthly, yearly basis? And unfortunately, I was thrown into a system where I met many of those minorities who were wrongfully convicted. And over the past 15 years, I think the evidence clearly demonstrates that wrongful convictions, it really doesn't matter what your color, your creed, your race, or your economic background. It happens to anyone and everyone. And it's something that our system cannot tolerate.
Well, it's something that our system shouldn't tolerate, but clearly it's something that our system not only tolerates, but has incorporated into its actual design. Let's take a look at a moment, just for a moment, at what your circumstances were. Certainly, if one had to suggest the best circumstances from which a person could be charged with a crime, we would want to be a white, middle-class, fairly well-off defendant in a violent crime. That's who we would want to be. And we'd want to have the resources to put forward the best defense we could. And that's what you had. And despite that, a terrible, terrible miscarriage occurred. Do you have any thoughts, Marty, about what the likelihood is, what the risk is for a defendant who wasn't as well situated as you under similar circumstances?
The end result would be tragedy. I can't tell you how many individuals I encountered over the years who literally were represented by, you know, attorneys that did not have the resources to conduct adequate investigations. They weren't represented by attorneys who had the depth of experience necessary to actually litigate complex and complicated homicide cases.
Well, you had an excellent attorney who was working for you.
Absolutely.
He knew how to handle a case like this. What was he up against that made this an unfair battle?
He was up against the largest law firm in Suffolk County, and that's the prosecutor's office. It's comparable to David versus Goliath. When you have a prosecutor's office who has the power to subpoena, the power to wiretap, and it's their obligation to disclose evidence, and they fail to disclose evidence, it's very difficult for a defense lawyer to conduct adequate investigations if they're not aware of witness tampering, if they're not aware of evidence.
Well,
so when the prosecutors withhold all of that power, and there's this level of protection there, it's difficult for defense lawyers to do their jobs.
Well, I seem to understand that in your case, the actual investigating detective who was responsible for the charges being brought against you had some prior relationships with some of the key actors in your case. Is that right?
That is correct. Through the post-conviction proceedings, witnesses testified that Detective McCready and Jerry Stuerman. Detective McCready was the lead detective in my case, and Jerry Stuerman was my father's business partner, were not only friends, they were business associates.
Let's just back up on that a second.
Sure.
Are you telling me that the lead detective in your case was a business associate of the person that you had identified as the likely perpetrator of this crime?
That's what several witnesses testified to during the post-conviction proceedings, yes.
All right. And what other relationships existed that you were unaware of during the trial of the case?
We had some suspicious activity occurred during jury deliberations where we had a juror who was accused of giving hand signals to a prosecutor. We had a juror who went out golfing after the conviction with the lead detective and the prosecutor. The lead detective, we later learned, had essentially intimidated witnesses by showing them crime scene photos. He had manipulated witnesses by bringing witnesses into an evidence locker room prior to their testifying, suggesting that we know Marty's guilty, look at all this evidence, you should testify that way. It was just pure and simple misconduct on the part of this detective, and we're hopeful that through additional discovery we'll learn the depth of the misconduct of other individuals.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment because, of course, the lead detective in any prosecution is not an independent operator. He operates at the instruction and on behest of the prosecutor. Was the prosecutor aware of any of this during the trial of the case?
I don't think any of that has really come out yet. And right now I have two civil suits pending. And we're hopeful through the discovery process we really learn who knew what.
Was the judge aware of any of this during the trial of the case?
Well, the judge did become aware of the shenanigans that took place during jury selection. We were not aware of Detective McCready's intimidation of witnesses by showing bloody crime scene photos or bringing witnesses into the evidence locker room. No, I'm not sure if the prosecutor knew at that point what he did, but maybe during discovery we'll learn what he knew.
Well, shortly after your conviction, evidence started appearing that had not been available during the trial of the case, and I have to believe that that newly discovered evidence was presented to the prosecutor.
Each time we did have new evidence that we presented to the prosecutor, nothing was done. Even in the most recent round of litigation, we brought new witnesses, new evidence in 2004 to the prosecutor's office in a good faith effort to allow them to investigate this case and essentially do the right thing, and they failed.
Well,
we actually filed a post-conviction motion.
Well, isn't it true that the actual district attorney who had responsibility for this, in fact, represented the partners, your father's partner's son, for selling cocaine at an earlier point in his practice?
That is correct, and the district attorney himself had represented McCready at a criminal proceeding that McCready had subsequent to my conviction.
Wait a minute. You're telling me, let me clear about this.
Sure.
You know, these things come out and they go by us, but let's just think about how important what it is you just said. You're saying that the prosecutor represented as a defense attorney before he became a prosecutor the lead detective in the case against you.
In 1992, 1993, Detective McCready had an assault case. And at that point, Thomas Spoto represented McCready in that criminal proceeding.
And was that sort of conflict ever made? Were you aware of that kind of conflict before the trial of this case?
He wasn't the prosecutor at the time of the trial. He was the prosecutor during the most recent post-conviction proceedings.
Well, right, but he's the person who stood up and said, no, we're not going to reopen this case.
That is correct. We did ask for a special prosecutor multiple times because throughout the post-conviction proceeding, multiple pieces of evidence came to light which indicated even more of a conflict. Each time we did file an application for a special prosecutor, that application was denied.
And before we get to the denouement of this story, the resolution of this story, I don't want people to think that your efforts to draw attention to this occurred only as a result of your access to financial resources. How did you get anybody to pay attention to your case after your conviction?
I wrote thousands and thousands and thousands of letters. After my conviction, I was actually represented by competent counsel in New York State. But by 1995, the firm that they worked for had expended a significant amount of pro bono hours, and they couldn't represent me anymore. So I ended up going on a letter-writing campaign to try to find counsel that could represent me pro bono.
And that was a successful effort?
It was a successful effort by a unusual situation where a girl I went to high school with had worked in the bagel stores with Stuerman, who knew me, who knew Stuerman, and she was also going to law school, and she was also interning at a law firm in Washington, D.C. And she knew I was looking for counsel, and she presented my case to Stephen Braga, who was essentially the pro bono person at the firm, of Miller, Cassidy, LaRocca, and Lewin, and they decided to take my case in 1995, and they, along with almost a dozen other lawyers kind of left and joined the case over the years, but they represented me up until the time that the case was dismissed against me.
If you hadn't have had that connection with your high school friend who happened to have been at that firm, do you have any belief about where you would be today?
I would most likely still be in prison writing letters. It really was the luck of getting competent, dedicated, zealous lawyers to advocate on my behalf, knowing that I was innocent, knowing that the system wasn't functioning as long as I was incarcerated. What was very interesting about the team of lawyers is that while they all started as a team, many of the lawyers left and joined new firms. Each time they joined a new firm, their contract with the new firm was that they were able to continue working on my case. Every time they ran a new firm, they were able to recruit more lawyers. It seems every lawyer that ever got involved in the case could never abandon it because it became such a passion for them, knowing that this was one of the things that they went to law school for, was to ensure that an innocent person doesn't get convicted, and if he does get convicted, you find a way to get them out of jail.
Right. Well, a point in time came that those efforts actually became effective. Can you tell us what happened and how that occurred?
Sure. In 2001, it was after years of litigation ended up being failed every step of the way, that I decided to hire a private investigator by the name of J. Salpeter. J. Salpeter worked with the lawyers that were working on my case to essentially conduct a whole reinvestigation. Jay started from scratch. He looked at Jerry Sturman. Jerry Sturman's son was a convicted drug dealer, and Jay started kind of tracking out criminal associates. Through Jay's investigation, he was able to identify who the getaway driver was from my parents' murder. And from there, he was able to identify the individuals that were directly responsible for the murders. With that evidence in hand, we did polygraph examinations of several witnesses, and we presented this evidence to the district attorney in 2004.
So that was in 2004, and at that point, when you presented that evidence to them, they released you from jail, and that was the end of the story, right?
Not even close. We actually went to them in August and basically said, you know what, we're going to give you a period of time to investigate this. After almost 2 months of nothing being done, we ended up filing the post-conviction motion in Suffolk County, and it was in July of 2005 that we actually started hearings on the post-conviction evidence.
Well, and this post-conviction evidence, it remarkably included an affidavit from the person who actually drove the getaway car from your house on September 7th, 1988. Isn't that right?
We had an affidavit from him, but the final witness really should have, it was the icing on the cake, was Joseph Creedon's son, Joseph Garacio, testified in open court that his father, Joseph Creedon, confessed to him that he was involved in the murders.
So we have the confession of the person who committed the crime, not under duress of police investigation. The man admits it to his son. His son testifies to that effect. We have the affidavit of the person who drove the getaway car, and you're still telling us that the person who committed this murder is walking our streets.
That's correct. There are other individuals that were involved, and through 18 months of hearings that were sporadically going on, because at one point a witness testified that there was a conflict and we had special hearings on that. But even after 18 months, we had multiple admissions, multiple people testify about all the individuals that were involved. And every one of those individuals continued to walk the streets, continued to commit crimes. To this day, every one of those individuals has been essentially uncharged regarding to my parents' murders.
Well, your post-conviction lawyers achieved a real success on December 21, 2007. What happened on that date?
It was actually a Friday. I remember After
where were you?
I was in Great Meadow Correction Facility in Comstock, New York. But I mean, just before we get to that point, I mean, I lost in Suffolk County. We filed appeals. We had an amazing oral argument in the appellate division in September, and essentially it was the last week of the year, and it was essentially the final day of December when decisions could be released. And I was in Great Meadow Correction Facility, and it was I called in the morning, called my lawyers in the morning, and nobody knew anything. At lunchtime, I called, and literally every person I called was, we won. And nobody could really explain to me what we won at that point, because everybody, I think, was in such a state of shock. It wasn't until I called the local counsel of Long Island, Bruce Marquette, that he was able to explain to me what we won. And essentially, it was at that point I realized that the convictions were reversed, and I was granted a new trial.
How much longer did you spend in jail after that?
A few days. Bruce Marquette, my family, all the lawyers involved, Barry Pollack, Stephen Braga, Jennifer O'Connor, made every effort possible to have me brought down to Suffolk County and released on bail. And it was on December 27th that I was actually released on bail. But it was very interesting. It was the day that I spoke to Bruce Marquette, and I've always joked that I've always made sure he kept his word, is that he said, pack all your property, you're never seeing the inside of a jail cell again. And, you know, I've always told him, I said, Bruce, in law school now, I understand contract law. You made a contract with me. I'm glad you kept it.
Well, the day after the appellate division in the in Suffolk, that covered Suffolk County, issued its decision, the New York Times broke a story that the New York State Investigation Commission had begun an official investigation into Suffolk County law enforcement handling of your case. That was in December of 2007. What's been the result of that?
The commission tragically lost some of its most important members during the investigation, and the final report came out that found that there was some misconduct, but not everything was misconduct. In my opinion, that the report was a whitewash, because anybody who knows the facts of the case, there's a lot of facts in the final report that are distorted, that don't comply with what individuals testified to. And the commission that actually, State Investigative Commission, has actually been disbanded now.
And when did that final report come out?
Months later.
Sometime in January of 2008.
Yeah, that could be correct.
Yeah. So in the middle of January, Governor Spitzer appointed now Governor Cuomo, then Attorney General, as a special prosecutor, and he promised to follow the evidence wherever it leads us. Did he do that?
Well, it was very interesting. It was initially Thomas Spoda with the DA of Suffolk County promised to dismiss the indictments. And from the time that he promised to dismiss the indictments, Bruce Marquette attempted to get me into court so the indictments were dismissed. And unfortunately, that never happened, and former governor appointed a special prosecutor, the Attorney General. And after their investigation of 6 months, they ended up dismissing the indictments against me.
And his statement, that is Attorney General Cuomo at that point, at the end of June of 2008, said that they weren't going to retry you because there was, quote, insufficient evidence to prove your guilt. Isn't that correct?
That is correct.
And it took another month before the state Supreme Court in Suffolk County actually dismissed all the charges against you.
That is correct.
Well, Marty, it's an incredible story. It's a horrifying story. I'm a father of four kids, and the notion that any one of them could ever be arrested for something that they didn't do is horrifying. I can't imagine what the rest of your family must have felt for the 17 years that you spent in jail. I further, though, can't imagine how you process that experience. What has that done to you?
It's been an unimaginable nightmare. I had a philosophy that when I was in prison, that my body was there, but my mind and soul wasn't. But it breaks you down emotionally, physically, beyond belief. Many people have always asked me, you know, what was it like to live in a prison cell? And there really is no easy way to describe it. I've told people, I said, try to find a bathroom that's 6x9, has a toilet, a sink, and a bathtub. I said, but your bathtub becomes your bed. I said, and essentially have somebody lock you in there. And you have no control of when you come out. And that may give you a little sense of what it's like just to be in a prison cell. That doesn't encompass the everyday, you know, goings-on of prison, where there's violence, where there's, you know, mental instability, where there's abuses that go on, where there are individuals that violate other individuals' rights. It really doesn't encompass it. I mean, I've been fortunate upon my release to actually have a, you know, positive outlook on life. You know, shortly after I was released, I enrolled at Hofstra University. I got my bachelor's degree. After graduating from Hofstra, I enrolled at Toro Law School, and I'm a student there now. I'm a paralegal that works with Bruce Barquette and Amy Marion. We've established recently a prisoner's rights project where I'm able to help prisoners whose rights are violated. But I'm one of the fortunate ones. I can't tell you how many innocent prisoners I've met who have gone out of jail who haven't been able to take the path that I have.
Well, Marty, you know, it to me feels like an incredible stretch to call you lucky. You spent 17 years of your life fighting to prove that the government that you relied upon to do the right thing had not done the right thing. And I wonder if you have a sense of how prevalent that situation was amongst the people that you were in jail with for 17 years.
Let me just clarify one thing. When I use the term lucky, you have to understand the totality of the situation. I'm free. I can't tell you how many more men aren't free who are innocent. So I am one of those lucky ones that actually was dedicated enough and had the little bits of luck along the way that ended up securing my freedom. But there's probably 5 to 10% of the prison population that is innocent. Many of these men don't have the knowledge, they don't have the wherewithal, they don't have those little bits of luck that will get them their freedom. You know, I say I'm lucky is because I'm not in a prison cell. Had I not had those little bits of chance, those little bits of, you know, meeting the right person, writing the right letter that day, or, you know, having a girl that I went to high school with work in a bagel store who ended up going to law school, ended up working in a law firm.
Or been surrounded or been lucky enough to get incredibly dedicated and talented attorneys like Bruce Barquette to represent you for all of those years, only because they knew it was the right thing and because they were committed to doing what our song at the beginning of this show said, that was just to stand by you because it was the right thing. Now, Marty, the statistics are staggering. There's almost 1.7 million people in jail now. And if you're right that maybe 10% of those are innocent, that's 170,000 people languishing in jail.
Even if you take away the 10% number, isn't one innocent person in jail one too many?
Well, isn't our entire system is predicated on the notion that 10 guilty people should go free to avoid one innocent person being in jail, but that's not really the way it works, is it?
No. As I've said, you know, quite often people think you've been charged with a crime, you're guilty of something. And quite often law enforcement, and I'm not saying all law enforcement, there are some in law enforcement who look to take the easy road, who don't look to investigate a case fully, to ensure that the person that's sitting at a defense table is guilty. And our prison systems are filled with tragic upon tragic stories. I can't tell you how many letters that I get every week from guys in jail saying, Marty, I'm innocent, you know what it's like, you know, please look into my case. You know, I'm only a paralegal. I don't have the ability to do this. I mean, Bruce Barquette is one lawyer. You know, Barry Scheck's Innocence Project gets hundreds, if not thousands, of letters, you know, a week. Well, during my con, I wrote 50,000 letters. I'm sure there are many lawyers who are listening to this radio show that got a letter from me once, twice, maybe four or five times.
You know, you mentioned Barry Scheck's Innocence Project, and of course, the work that he does is extraordinary and extraordinarily important. Let's be clear, though, that that the cases that he investigates, that's the low-hanging fruit, isn't it?
It is.
Those are the cases where there's DNA evidence that is available that absolutely establishes innocence. That didn't exist in your case, and it's less than 1% of all of the criminal cases that are presented have DNA evidence.
I agree. And unfortunately, the media essentially portrays every time there's a DNA exoneration that that's the norm. We don't, in a lot of cases where there's been an exoneration where there's non-DNA, the media doesn't kind of take the story up because it's not as thrilling, it's not as exciting. But it's still there, another innocent man who's been incarcerated for a crime he didn't commit, which has enabled the guilty parties to continue to roam the streets and commit crimes. That's the one thing I think we fail to realize in this system, is that when you incarcerate an innocent individual, the guilty parties have remained free and committed additional crimes. I mean, in New York State, there was Jeffrey Deskovich's case where the individual who was guilty in that case went on to kill another girl. How often does this happen? I mean, it's tragic.
Well, and in case after case, where there are exonerations, where we've had the ability to establish that the wrong person was convicted, usually because of either prosecutorial or detective misconduct, we know that there is no follow-up with those people. Those prosecutors continue prosecuting cases. There's no discipline for them. Those detectives continue arresting people and testifying in court as though they had never done anything wrong. It's case after case. I'd like you in the last couple of minutes that we have, Marty, to let us know how you think we as citizens ought to view our criminal justice system.
Our criminal justice system is flawed, and there's no easy way around it. However, we as citizens can demand improvements. I've testified before a Senate committee on wrongful convictions, and one of the issues that I've really pushed for is the electronic recording of interviews and interrogations. And what bothers me most at many of these events that I've testified at, somebody from law enforcement has got up there and said, it costs too much for us to do that, or we don't want suspects to know what's going on in the interrogation room. My responses are very simple. If you're doing nothing wrong in that interrogation room, don't be afraid of the videotape. And the other thing is that, what is the cost of an electronic recording of any interview or interrogation? Are you telling me the price that I pay for 17 years in prison is equal to an electronic recording of an interview or an interrogation? I mean, my cell phone could record an hour of an interview and interrogation. The flip phone could be an hour and a half. I mean, the Queens DA's office is now using an electronic recording of their quote-unquote interview and interrogation. When it benefits them, it's never too expensive. Why couldn't my life have been saved? Why couldn't 17 years of my life been saved if they would have just electronically recorded what took place in the interrogation room?
Marty, I want to end on that point. It's an incredibly important one. Our next show, the first Sunday of June at 11 o'clock, is going to address some of the sorts of changes that can take place to avoid exactly this kind of miscarriage. Marty, so long. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Says, no matter who you are, no matter where you go in your life, at some point you're going to need somebody to stand by you. Oh yeah, oh my darling, stand by me. No matter who you are, no matter where you go in life, you gonna need somebody to stand by you. No matter how much money you got, all the friends.
and the land is dark, and that moon is the only light we see. No, I won't be afraid. No, I won't shed one tear just as long as your people come and stand by me.
W.